In the middle of the 19th century, a successful businessman, Chicago, experienced a number of personal tragedies. But he resolved not to be crushed by them. Instead, he renewed his faith in God, and in 1873 wrote words that became the basis of an inspiring hymn called "It Is Well With My Soul." This is the story of how that hymn came to be written.
There was an issue with the PowerPoint. We'll start again. Thank you. Okay, we will read the lyrics from the DVD because we have no voice, it seems, just the music. Carries a tremendous message, Horatio Spafford wrote. The text is beautiful. It is certainly biblical. It conveys a great truth that you and I know to exist in the world, but yet to come off a broken heart of a man who went through some unbelievable things, it is really a tremendous benchmark. Cornerstone here of the church. The story of It Is Well With My Soul. Following the end of the Civil War, Chicago, Illinois stood as the gateway to the American West. Business commerce boomed along the shores of Lake Michigan. The population tripled in less than a decade. And where routes connecting a half of continent intersecting the heart of the city, the bird pangs of a metropolis were unmispeakable. As a Chicago grew, so did the fortunes of anyone with the capital and ambition to invest in its future. One of these men was Horatio Spafford. Spafford came from New York State, and he came to Chicago. He was well on his way. Of course, he was a lawyer, plus the fact that he was knowledgeable in real estate, had to do a lot of closings and sure, and saw bargains when they were there and became involved in it. Through those efforts, profited greatly from his investments in real estate. He considered material wealthy as only a fragment of his true fortune. His reputation for integrity had earned him the respect of his peers throughout the city. In his wife Anna and her youngest children, he had a family he adored. And through his tireless support of both his church and the ministry of evangelist Dwight Light Moodley, he found tremendous spiritual fulfillment. Overwhelmed by his prosperity, Spafford frequently observed that he had been blessed beyond measure. Then, beginning of 1871, his life, so rich in joy and contentment, would be cracked by an unbelievable success of tragedies. That winter, Horatio and Anna's only son died of scarlet fever. Several months later, the 8th of October, his family still grieved his loss. Disaster struck again. Within 24 hours, most of Chicago's downtown area and north side homes were destroyed. These hundreds of people lost their lives, and 98,000 were left homeless. People were driven into the lake, and many millions of dollars worth of damage occurred at that time. It had virtually wiped out Horatio Spafford's real investments. So that was an extreme tragedy in his life. Yet, despite his enormous personal losses, Spafford went to work after the fire, helping friends who had suffered even greater setbacks than his own. By the fall of 1873, the reconstruction of Chicago was still years from completion. Spafford's friend, D.L. Moody, had traveled to England to continue his ministry, and in November, Horatio decided to follow the evangelist overseas, hoping that a change of scenery and routine would lift the spirits of his family.
he purchased 6 fares on the French ocean liners Ville du Port, one of the finest passenger vessels in the world. The day before Spafford's were scheduled to leave Chicago, Horatio received word that he was needed immediately for urgent business meetings regarding property he had lost in the fire. Despite his obligations, Spafford insisted that his wife and daughters leave for England without him. He would join them there in a few weeks. On November 19, 1873, the Ville du Havre departed from New York. 4 days later, into the voyage, the ship encountered heavy fog in the North Atlantic. Just past midnight, on November 26, the Lockern, an iron-hulled English sailing vessel, rammed the Ville du Havre broadside. The luxury liner sunk in less than 12 minutes. 226 passengers, including Spafford's 4 daughters, perished at sea. An hour after the accident, Anna Spafford, barely alive and clinging to a piece of wreckage, was pulled from the icy waters. Several days later, her rescue ship reached Cardiff, Wales. Her cabled her husband in Chicago. She sent a 2-word message, saved alone. The loss of his infant son, devastating financial setback, and now the deaths of his 4 beloved daughters. Yet, in the face of unimaginable pain, Spafford clung desperately to faith in God. Confiding to a friend that I am glad to trust the Lord when it will cost something, he immediately booked passage to a ship bound for England to join his beloved wife. The journey was long, and Horatio spent the hours deep in prayer and contemplation. 4 days into the crossing of the captain told Spafford, "I believe we are passing over the spot where the Ville du Havre went down." As the grieving father gazed into the weary grave of his children, a torrent of emotion rushed into his broken heart. I am sure he remained with joy. All the children were dead, they were gone. And he said later, he went through some deeps he had never experienced in his life before. But he said, through all in all, it seemed that in the deeper, darker depth, all of the sudden of light of God promises seemed to shine in my heart. He said, I couldn't do anything else but express it in a way that I had to gift for. I was not a poet by trade, but I loved to write poetry. And he said that, without even a moment's hesitation, the testimony began to flow from my heart through my pen. In that extraordinary moment, sorrow became hope, as Spafford now strengthened by the assurance that he one day be renowned with his children in heaven, returned to his cabin and penned one of the most profound expressions of faith ever recorded.
Wow.
attended my way, when sorrows like sea below roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul. It's just a marvelous way to wrote it. You're on the sea with him, and here we are on the sea of the life. This is what he's painting there, the picture. But though all the troubles, whatever you go through, and it says in the whether it be financial, whether it be physical, but though it all, God will never leave you, he will not forsake you. And you can say that can hurt the body, but my soul is well. After the accident, Anna and Horatio Spafford visited with neighbors and friends. That afternoon, Spafford shared his poem with the renowned songwriter Philip Bliss, one of the history's greatest composers of sacred music. Bliss was so moved by the power of Spafford's text that he sat down and within moments created a melody for the ages. It was a perfect wedding of words and music, and the hymn that offer immeasurable comfort and hope for the world was born. In 1932, gospel songwriter Thomas Andrew Dorsey was in his early 30s and a fairly new husband. One hot afternoon in August, Dorsey had to travel 300 miles from Chicago to St. Illinois, where he was featured soloist at a large revival meeting. His wife, Nettie, was in the last month of pregnancy. It was to be the couple's first child. The next night, at the St. Louis revival, the crowd called on him to sing again and again. When he finally finished, a boy ran up with a telegram containing the words, "Your wife just died." He rushed home to discover his wife had died, giving birth to a boy. Few hours later, the baby died. Dorsey buried his wife and the little baby together in the same casket. Then he fell apart. He felt God had done him an injustice, and he did not want to write any more gospel songs. Then one day, a friend took him to a music school in the neighborhood. It was quiet. And as his hand began to touch the keys of a piano, something happened. He felt at peace, as though he couldn't reach out and touch God. The melody just fell into place. He says of that moment, "As the Lord gave me these words and melody, he also healed my spirit." I learned that when we are in our deepest grief is when he is closest. It is a time when we are most open to his restoring power. And so I go on living for God willingly and joyfully until that day comes when he will take me and gently lead me home. The best known, "What a Friend We Have in Jesus," is number 321 in the American Hymn Book. Here is how that hymn came to be written. Is a tremendous hymn as far as it's an explanation of who God is. Obviously, the message is there, a true friend. All of our needs and sorrows there. Bring it to the Lord in prayer. He cares. He sustains. I don't know about you, but how many times we fail to realize what a friend we do have in the Lord. In the spring of 1844, the hills of Ireland were green. Clouds drifted across painted skies, and for young Irishmen, the future was filled with hope and promise. Joseph Scriven had completed his university education and returned to his home outside of Dublin. He was engaged to his childhood love and soon planned to take her hand in marriage. On the day before their wedding, Scriven's fiancée rode out to meet him on the banks of the river bank. In a terrifying instant, her horse was stalled, and she was thrown headfirst into the rushing waters, knocked unconsciously. By the fall, she drowned moments before Scriven arrived. And they were taking the body out of the water, and he was close enough to look, and he looked into the face of the girl that he was supposed to marry the next day, and he said later, "The bottom of my world seemed to just disappear." And he said, "Whenever I looked after that in Ireland, I always was reminded of the wonderful day I looked forward to that never had occurred." Emotionally shattered by the death of his love, Joseph Scriven turned to God for consolation and guidance. He decided to leave Ireland, and in 1845 he arrived in Ontario, Canada, where he would spend the rest of his life. Scriven settled near the town of Port Hope, on the shores of Lake Ontario. There, he committed himself to the ideals of Christ's Sermon on the Mount, devoting his life to helping others in need. Each day, he walked these roads, assisting widows, the sick, and the poor. It was said that he never once denied a request for help, and that his greatest desire was to reflect the love of God through his life. For nearly 40 years, Joseph Scriven was a living light of charity and faith in a small Canadian town. And for his acts of kindness, he came to be known as the Good Samaritan of Port Hope. So he devoted his life to love and good deeds for the people of his community there. And they saw him walking down the street carrying a sawhorse and a saw. And someone in the community said, "Wow, that's Joseph Scriven. He's willingly to saw wood for anyone." This particular individual said, "Boy, I'd like to hire him to do it for me. I'd love to find a sober young man to cut wood for me." And this individual responded, "Well, you won't get Joseph Scriven, because he only helps the people who cannot pay or have no resources for which to reimburse you." So he really did want to help people out of the goodness of his heart and because of God's grace. Joseph Scriven spent many years tutoring the children of Robert Pangeli, a retired British sea captain. it was in his house that he met and fell in love with Angeli's niece, Eliza Roche. They were to be married in the spring of 1854. Yet, only weeks before their wedding, tragedy struck Scriven's life for a second time. Eliza Roche became ill with pneumonia. Despite Joseph's vigilant care, she died at the age of 23. Once again, Scriven was heartbroken by the loss of the woman he loved, and once again, he found strength by turning to a God he looked upon as his closest friend. The following year, he wrote a poem to his mother in Ireland. His words describe this extraordinary friendship that had given him purpose and hope in the face of devastating pain. What a friend we have in Jesus. All our sins and griefs to bear. What a privilege to carry everything to God in prayer. Oh, what peace we often forfeit. Oh, what needless pain we bear. All because we do not carry everything to God in prayer. In simple yet eloquent language, Joseph Scriven, a man well acquainted by sorrow and loneliness, had defined for the world the essence of a right relationship with God. He saw his Creator not as an impersonal force to be feared, but as a loving father and friend whose greatest desire is to carry our burdens and ease our pains. For the rest of his life, Scriven would continue to demonstrate his faith throughout Port Hope. And today, more than a century after his death, his profound insights into the true character of God still resound in the legacy of a timeless hymn. Scriven's poem was first published anonymously. Nearly a decade passed before Scriven revealed to a neighbor and to the rest of the world that he and the Lord had written it together. Today, What a Friend We Have in Jesus stands amongst the most beloved hymns ever penned. And outside of Port Hope, a monument commemorates the life and work of a humble yet remarkable man who trusted God with the deepest burdens of his life and walked with him as his friend. Let us conclude this service by singing this wonderful hymn together.